So we're reconvened here, and we have a 30-minute request from Ms. Abby Taylor in Testenham. So it's all yours.
Tess Dunham, our attorney who represents us on this issue, you all know. My name is Abby Taylor Silva. I'm the Vice President of Policy and Communications for the Grower Shipper Association. Welcome to our region. And we represent four counties, Santa Cruz, Monterey, San Benito, and Santa Clara. So first I wanted to start with some appreciation.
And remember.
Slow it down. Okay. To staff and to the board, I wanted to thank you for providing the documents that you did in Redline. It really helped me and my members to quickly review changes, especially the second batch of changes, efficiently. And we've also appreciated your taking the time to meet with us and discuss concerns and ideas throughout this process. We also want to share appreciation for a few of the items that were updated in the current draft. We appreciate that the Order 3.0 no longer requires annual updates of the ENOI. We appreciate that you retain the 60-day notice and update period for the ENOI notice of termination. We appreciate that growers in Tier 3 now only submit the INMP effectiveness report once instead of annually. And we also appreciate that you moved the ENOI, ACF, and TNA reporting date from October 1 to March 1. That's going to be very helpful. We, of course, do still have some concerns with the draft order, and I'm going to touch on those before passing the microphone over to Tess to address more of the legal issues, including the state's anti-degradation policy and the interpretation and the findings. So regarding expanding the TNA reporting, we do remain concerned with the expansion of that reporting for all of the reasons that we already stated in our letter. We believe that there are substantial unknowns remaining due to the East San Joaquin order not being finalized, and we're concerned with expanding reporting to more than 1,000 ranches. While some who will have some of this new reporting have already conducted reporting on other ranches, for many this will be a challenging new requirement. And staff has pointed out in their reports that those conducting the TNA reporting who hadn't previously were generally filing the annual compliance form. And while that is true, it is important to note that the TNA report is substantially different. It's asking for new data and for over 1,000 ranches that aren't used to providing this data. And we believe that the time estimates of 4 hours per ranch and then fewer in subsequent years still are probably not quite what it's going to take. And I think you're going to hear from some growers after I speak and Tess speaks who are going to elaborate a little bit more on that. We also believe it's inappropriate to require reporting under this order for a time period before the order is effective. So the way that it's currently written, it says that growers will report from the beginning of the year or actually if they planted earlier than the beginning of the year on a product to be harvested in this period that they would report. And while we appreciate staff said that they, you know, they're going to, of course, be reasonable and understand, we still feel that it really should start on the day that the order is adopted. We also echo our partners with Monterey County Farm Bureau and our concern that analysis of this information will be influenced by just a handful of crop nutrient uptake studies performed on the Central Coast compared to the number of crops we grow. There are only about 10% of our crops have a nutrient uptake study associated with them. So when you take into account the variables inherent to nitrogen application standards, due to more than 40 soil descriptions in Monterey County alone, planting timing and season, crop varieties, planting depths, crop rotation cycles, we just don't believe we have enough information to appropriately analyze the nutrient application for all these crops at this time, which is what concerns us, and that they are going to be analyzed without all of that data and all of that information. I want to touch briefly on adding neonicotinoids to the sampling program. As was noted in Kay Mercer's letter to you, according to DPR's Pesticide Use Reports database, thiacloprid is not being used on crops on the Central Coast. Additionally, I don't actually believe that it's registered for use in California. As I could find, it wasn't used on any crops statewide in 2014, the year for which the DPR data is most recently available. And so for that reason, I would recommend removing thiacloprid from the MRP. We also agree with our partners at San Luis Obispo Farm Bureau in recommending that there need to be more scientific findings demonstrating that the sampling and monitoring increases are truly beneficial. And we're concerned that the urban use of these materials could be contributing to the increased use on the Central Coast, as they are widely available at home improvement supply stores. And the poundage estimates by DPR don't include urban uses, so we may be putting the cost of one industry rather than putting this on the cost of one industry rather than taking the time to better understand use. I would recommend we try to work with municipalities, as they also currently are or likely will begin soon testing for neonicotinoids in their stormwater programs so that we can better coordinate and share monitoring responsibilities. We encourage the regional board to wait a year and take the time to allow for further research and discussion of use and opportunities to coordinate monitoring before adding another material, neonics, to the surface water monitoring suite, which is funded by agriculture. So with that, I will step back and I'll let Tess take the microphone. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Abby. For those of you, a couple of new board members who I have not had the pleasure of appearing before, my name is Tess Dunham. I am an attorney at SOMAC Simmons & Dunn in Sacramento. Just to provide very brief background, because it will help to provide some context for some of the comments I'm going to make for those who don't know me. I do a considerable amount of work in the water quality area throughout California before all the regional boards, and in fact, I also represent the East San Joaquin Water Quality Coalition, so I have very specific knowledge as to what's going on within the Region 5 Irrigated Lands Program and my representation of them. I also represent folks with respect to the pyrethroid process in Region 5, so I'll provide a little bit of information on that. So just to give you a little bit of perspective on my background in some of these comments I'm going to make. So first I am going to talk a little bit about the Region 5 pyrethroid process. Just there was some discussion yesterday, and I want to just provide a little bit further clarification with respect to what is going on in Region 5 and what is not. There was discussion about benchmarks. Region 5 is in the process of a basin plan amendment right now with respect to pesticides, the use of pyrethroids. Their basin plan amendment proposes to use some calculated criteria using a University of California Davis methodology as a trigger. It is not to be used to interpret the narrative objective. They're looking at it as a trigger to trigger the use of management practices. And while they have identified what the US EPA benchmarks are, they are not using those to interpret the narrative objective, or at least the staff recommendation is not to use those to interpret the narrative objective. So just a little bit of clarification as to what is going on with respect to the pyrethroid values that are being discussed in Region 5, and can help provide any further information on that people may have. I also think it's important, based upon some of the conversation yesterday, and I'll touch upon it when I talk about nitrate loading limits and some of that discussion, but there was also some reference with respect to, is it appropriate to put some type of a pesticide use limit with respect to pesticide usage within this program. And I just want to remind, and I know the board members and staff are well aware of this, but remind the board that the use of pesticides is actually specifically regulated under the California Food and Agriculture Code, and is specifically that jurisdiction is left to the Department of Pesticide Regulation under the code. So the regional board, of course, you have the ability to set criteria. You have the ability to address pesticides through water quality criteria. You are limited in your legal authority in order to actually adopt any requirement that could otherwise be construed as putting some type of a restriction on use of the pesticide itself. And on the issue of pesticides, I also just want to make, you know, just a little bit of a personal note. Yesterday, there was an individual who mentioned studies linking organophosphates to autism. And as a mother of a child on the autism spectrum, I tell you, I've read everything as to what could be a potential cause of autism, from mercury in vaccines to the age of my spouse to premature birth. And there have been so many different hypotheses. I take every hypothesis relating to what causes autism with a big grain of salt. And that's coming from my own personal experience. Next, with respect to the issue of nitrogen loading limits and discussion that occurred yesterday, with some of the representatives from the environmental community and the discussion with Mr. Kane. I think it's important to really note that, first of all, I would say that a loading limit and an effluent limit are very different and need to be looked at very differently. It is not easy to say that, well, isn't it, you know, putting a limit on the use of nitrogen the same as having an effluent limit on a wastewater treatment plant? No, they're very different. One is a source control method. One is a limitation on a concentration in, you know, the quality of the water that's being discharged. Effluent limits are derived under federal regulations. And with respect to source control, I think you do run into issues with respect to whether you are dictating a specific manner of compliance, depending on how you're doing. But more so, I think the issue that we need to talk about with respect to metrics, and I do think it's an interesting discussion, that how I view it is the metric is an important part of determining whether a grower is implementing BPTC. You know, we talk about loading as a limitation, and I think that's where we get ourselves into problem. As a regulatory endpoint, I think that they're totally inappropriate. However, if they're used as a target and it informs the regional board staff as to whether someone is implementing best practical treatment or control, I think that's where it has its appropriate use and value. And it's a target, right? And then by looking at how it informs BPTC, you then take into account all of the variability that otherwise goes along with the use of such metrics. Soil, weather, you know, depth to groundwater, all the different variables that everybody has mentioned throughout the day also then informs whether that grower has specifically, you know, implemented BPTC based upon where they are within the range and other variables specific to their crop. Now, the issue of metrics, as you all probably know, is an issue before the State Water Board right now in the draft East San Joaquin order, and will be further discussed as we get the next draft, and it has been a big part of that discussion. There is discussion, should it be A over Y? Should it be A minus Y? Y is yield. But should it be A over R? Should it be A minus R? Should it be A over Y with the coalitions in the Central Valley that then calculate whether the A over R and inform people? I mean, there's... Oh, sorry. I get so excited. My apologies. So there is considerable discussion, and if you look again at the draft East San Joaquin order, the State Water Board draft specifically says that, you know, at this time they look at it as a potential target. And again, I think it's a target to inform what may be BPTC. And as a target, there's also the discussion of the need for better removal coefficient information that is specific to California, that is specific to California crops. Now, we have some removal rates that were shared yesterday, but the accuracy of those are in question. Their applicability to California and our cropping systems is in question. And in fact, the draft East San Joaquin order does raise this issue, and so did the State Water Board when it reviewed the 2012 permit adopted by this board, which is one of the reasons that the State Water Board gave for removing the A over R ratios that were in the 2012 order. That also leads me to remind the board that the A over R ratios were specifically a part of the litigation that is currently pending before the Third District Court of Appeal. And as we all know, that the Judge Frawley decision, contrary to much comment yesterday, has been stayed because of the appeal. This is Judge Frawley has actually opined on this when the Coast Keeper filed a motion for clarification. Judge Frawley issued a ruling on that motion for clarification and clearly stated that his decision is stayed pending the appeal at the Third District DCA. So just a reminder that, and regardless of what reference the State Board makes to it in a draft order or how that is used in LA with respect to this board and the 2012 order, it is specifically stayed. The next comment I want to make is specific to some of the discussion on replacement water. And then I'm going to talk briefly about BPTC. But I think it's just important. Now, first of all, I think we would all agree that there is a need to make sure that every Californian has safe and affordable drinking water. No one disputes that as an important fact. And in fact, we know that this is a big issue that's in discussion, not just here in the Central Coast, but in the Central Valley and at the state water level. The state board has been working on studies with respect to affordability, which is another component of it besides just having safe access. And no one is trying to dispute this as an important issue. I also think it's, you know, important to note that there are a number of, you know, chatter going on throughout the state as to how agriculture works with the state in addressing replacement water issues in Central Valley, here, and beyond. And I will say that tomorrow I'll be at Region 5, and we will be talking about the Region 5 Salt and Nitrate Management Plan, and that is how Region 5 is looking to try to address the replacement water issue, the replacement water order issue within Region 5. All I want to say here is provide some caution in that with respect to the order before you today, I think you have limited ability as to what you exactly say within this order as to mandating replacement water. Your authority for mandating replacement water currently resides under 13304 of the Water Code, which is the cleanup and abatement order provisions. And I'm not trying to suggest or advocate that the board should go out and issue numerous cleanup and abatement orders to address replacement water issues. I'm just trying to put some caution as to the extent of your authority here under Water Code Section 13269, or if you are adopting a waste discharge order under Water Code Section 13263, of exactly what you can or cannot do with respect to mandating replacement water order under this action today. So just some caution with respect to how that doesn't mean that the conversations shouldn't be happening of what we should all do collectively and cooperatively. Just want to make sure that we're, you know, I guess I'm a little bit of a purist in our statutory authority and want to make sure we're cautious as to how we're utilizing it. With respect to the issue of best practical treatment and control, I'm probably going to spin off just a little bit from what Ms. Fisher was saying earlier. And I do appreciate the revisions that have been made to the anti-degradation findings. As Mr. Delgado noted, we made significant comments with respect to the anti-degradation findings. We had some concerns that they weren't necessarily reflective of reality, and I think that they have been improved in the revisions that have been provided. I do think that there may be some additional clarification that will be helpful. In particular, with respect to the issue of BPTC, there was a lot of discussion yesterday about whether statements of BPTC and this being an iterative or an interim order is legal as saying that this order complies with best practical treatment and control. And I think it's a matter of terminology that's been used. BPTC is an evolving concept. What is BPTC today may not be BPTC in 2020 when we have the next order. This order does qualify and meet best practical treatment and control. And I think it's important that we state that. We're not stating that BPTC won't change as we develop the new order. We're recognizing that it will improve as we have metrics and we compare metrics to what people are doing. That may change what an individual discharger is doing to qualify for meeting best practical treatment or control. But I do think we need to clarify with some certainty that is the board's intent that the order as it's being proposed today does meet and comply with the anti-degradation policy and does constitute best practical treatment and control, and that the next revisions will be looking at how does BPTC evolve with more data, more information, and more time as we move forward. So I think those are just some suggestions I would have for clarification. Let me look at my... And actually, into that, Lori might recognize this, but there was a brilliant lawyer in Region 5 that wrote in a dairy general order, BPTC is an evolving concept that takes into account changes in technological feasibility of deploying new or improved treatment or control methodologies, new scientific insights regarding the effect of pollutants, and the economic realities that regulated industries face. Because these concepts evolve over time, Standard industry practices that are considered BPTC today may not be considered BPTC in the future. This is language that's in the information sheet of the 2013 Dairy General Order, which was revised based upon the appellate court decision in Agua. So I share that with you because I think it's a very accurate description of BPTC and how we should look at it. Looking at my notes, one other comment that I wanted to share, and it actually goes back to the pesticide issue. I want to remind everybody that when we were talking about pesticides and label requirements, pesticide labels and following them are regulations. They're not just a label. They're a requirement. Failure to follow the label is violation of the law, and enforcement should be and can be taken by the county agricultural commissioner's offices or the Department of Pesticide Regulation directly. And agriculture has constantly advocated the need for to make sure that those label requirements are enforced appropriately by county ag commissioners and DPR. So I just want to, and while labels are in fluctuation, they are regulations. With respect to the pyrethroids, they are currently under a registration review process by EPA right now. There's a number of models out there that are subject to comment here, I think, by the end of March or the end of May, where EPA is relooking at the registrations for the pyrethroids, and through that process will determine if additional changes need to be made to those labels in order to change or increase the requirements for the use with respect to those labels, and that is an ongoing process currently. And also with the pyrethroids, one of the important things to remember is they are not a pesticide that is thought to have human health exposure risks. Their risks have always been associated specifically with invertebrates and not with human health, and in some ways are arguably safer than the organophosphates because of the lack of the human health risk that might be associated with the organophosphates. So just a couple of other comments. I know my comments were kind of all over the board, but I guess just to address some of the comments that were made yesterday. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. So we'll start this time on my left. Mix a little bit. So, Mr. Johnson?
Whether or not I have a question here.
You need a little more time?
Yeah, I do. Thank you.
Mayor Delgado?
I just want to thank Tess because you say that you came about this in a scattered way, but I appreciate that you took one issue at a time, came back to the pesticides a second time, but I liked your organization and appreciate all your comments. So I'm looking them over to see if I have any questions as well. But thank
you. It was either that good or that bad.
I don't have any questions. Thank you both for your testimony. Appreciate you being here.
Mr. Young?
Okay, I have questions for both of you. And Abby, do we have any sense for how much urban use of pesticides is occurring, you know, like poundage-wise versus what ag uses?
Well, you know, it's hard to say on urban. We really don't. We really don't know how much people that I could find, how much people are taking off the shelves at Home Depot and such and using. I did look up some numbers from 2014 through DPR on use, you know, more commercial landscape application and things like that. And the numbers totaled, I think it was about 10,000 pounds. But again, that doesn't take into home use, account at home use. So we really don't know what that poundage is, at least that I could find.
But even at 10,000 pounds, that's kind of like a drop in the bucket.
And that's a piece, but yeah, it doesn't. Yeah. I mean, if we don't have the home use, it's really hard to know how much.
Right.
How much is really being used?
But the home use would be through spray cans and aerosols and things like that, and the liquids that you'd put into pumpers.
Yeah.
Okay. And Tess, it's good to see you again. It's been a couple of years.
We just get to come back for more fun,
Mr. Young. We come back for more every time we come back to a update on our order. We get to see you guys. So you mentioned the DPR is the one with the authority basically to regulate pesticide usage.
That's correct.
But I don't think that they're actually regulating how much gets applied, correct? They regulate simply based on what's on the label.
Well, DPR also can change labels to make them specific for California, which is unlike any other state in the nation.
Yeah.
And again, labels do dictate rates of application. And so when it comes to the use of the pesticide, the Food and Ag Code is very specific that that jurisdiction is limited. For example, a number of years ago, there were counties that tried to prohibit the use of pesticides for aerial spraying, for medfly and other types of things, and the courts basically declared that the county does not have the authority to do so because mm-hmm. of the sole jurisdiction to DPR.
Okay, so how long have you been involved with representing ag? How far back does your...
20 years.
20 years. So in the 20 years, has DPR ever changed a label?
Absolutely.
And about, you have an estimate for how many times that has happened?
No, but it happens frequently. And, you know, for example, taking the pyrethroids, they adopted the surface water protection regulations recently in, 2012, that basically provided additional measurements and requirements on how professional applicators are to apply pesticides, you know, the commercial applicators when they go to homes, based upon numerous studies that were done over a number of years. Years ago when I held Ms. Fisher's job at the California Farm Bureau in the late 90s, we were involved in specific changes with respect to methyl bromide usage and methyl iodide. And there are a number of different examples of where DPR has done just that and has changed labels specific to California.
Okay. My question is circling around. I'm trying to pull it back down. It's related to this, and it has to do with your reaction to this. If labeling requirements have been generally followed and adhered to by agriculture, why is it that we have areas, surface waters, that are toxic? In other words, do we have misapplication and not following the labeling requirements, or are the labeling requirements not protective enough of surface waters?
Are you distinguishing between agricultural and urban uses?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Because I don't want to speak for the urban use. So with respect to the agricultural uses, as far as labeling, you know, and I know the pyrethroids the best, as many of you know. I represent the pyrethroid working group, so I have, you know, inherent knowledge with respect to those labels. There are buffer restrictions on the pyrethroid labels that need to be followed. There may not necessarily be limitations on irrigation return flow restrictions. So you could have the irrigation return flow, if it's not controlled, be a potential pathway for the pesticides entering into surface waters. There also may be, I don't know if there are aerial applications of the pyrethroids here or not, but, you know, whether there's any type of drift, of course, people are supposed to be careful and take into account circumstances to avoid any drift that might drift into a surface water. But I also think we have to be careful of just saying that because we have seen toxicity, whether we, whether if you're talking Chironomus with respect to the neonicotinoids or you're talking about toxicity to Hyalella, unless you also know exactly the concentration with respect to those pesticides or have done some type of a toxicity identification evaluation, you don't know what's necessarily always caused the toxicity. Everybody makes a presumption that just because you have toxicity to Hyalella, that is automatically caused by a pyrethroid. that may or may not be the case. We've often seen in some instances where you can have toxicity to Hialeah, and there may not be even be presence of pyrethroids. So I think we have to be a little cautious when we equate toxicity automatically with presence of a specific pesticide causing that toxicity.
So let's put aside the fact that it might not be completely indicative of a specific pesticide, but can we say that it's indicative of a pesticide exposure?
Not necessarily. Salinity impacts toxicity. You can have algal toxicity. There's a number of different types of factors. You can have, whether if you've done a bioassessment, based upon the health of the stream, we know that a lot of times hydromodifications are the biggest impact to the health of a stream versus, concentrations of different pesticides. There's so many different factors. And I'm not saying, not trying to say that pesticides are never have an impact on surface water, because that's not the point I'm trying to make. I'm just trying to make that as was talked about yesterday, very broad generalities are very difficult with respect to this environment. And I think it's difficult to say that just because we have a pesticide in a waterway, that's indicative of someone, either the label requirements aren't tough enough or people aren't following them. And I don't necessarily think that's always the case.
Okay. And I'm trying to get educated and understand exactly where we're going with this, because, there's a problem. And so how do we kind of try to wrap ourselves around a solution to it? We don't have a lot of toxicity in surface waters in areas outside ag regions.
That's not the case. You have a lot of toxicity
in
urban
stuff. Yeah, but outside of an urban area, but, outside of our heavy agricultural use areas, I don't believe we have a lot of toxicity present in surface waters.
I don't know. I couldn't answer that one way or the other.
I've seen a lot of our staff's, graphing and reporting of this, and, there's a pretty good overlap and correlation with the presence of ag and, groundwater levels with nitrogen and also surface water contamination. So I think it's reasonable to say it's there. I'm trying to get around how we approach this in terms of trying to lessen the impact from it. So when you talk about DPR and its regulatory authority, I start to look at the labeling requirements and get, kind of uncomfortable or lack confidence that there's enough there. And then when we've had our ag commissioners testify in years past, and they say, look, this isn't our focus when we do our inspections, our focus is employee applicator safety. We want to make sure that the labels are being followed so that people aren't being exposed to pesticides while they're being applied. And inspections done after the fact of application to look at surface waters and to look at the buffer requirements to see if they've been satisfied just isn't happening from what we've been told.
I can't speak to that. I wasn't.
Right. Well, I know you might have.
I don't know what these county ag commissioners have testified to or not, Mr. Young, so I can't speak to what they've said. I think that's unfortunate if they're not enforcing the label requirements for all of their purposes. I would not advocate that they I can understand they're trying to prioritize resources based upon human health exposure first, but I have always been, in my 20 years in representing agriculture, an advocate of the ag commissioners and the Department of Pesticide Regulation enforcing all provisions of the label requirements, including buffer restrictions, and if they're not doing that's unfortunate.
Well, that's just what they've told us. I think it's a prioritization that they go through, and maybe they lack staff to do it.
I will say around the pyrethroid issue, I know that I and K-Mercer and others have spent time with Monterey County staff discussing buffers and discussing the appropriate application of buffer requirements in different situations, and that they have been very thoughtful about that. So I'll just add that to the conversation.
Okay. Now, in our basin plan, don't we have a prohibition against any toxicity in surface waters? Isn't it kind of pretty black and white?
No. Well, you have a narrative toxicity objective about, you know, it's not a no detect, it's toxicity. I don't have the exact language memorized from your basin plan, but it's pretty standard in all of the basin plans that you can't have toxicity that impacts the beneficial uses more or less. How one interprets whether there's an impact to the beneficial use, there's a lot of subjectivity within that, but it's not a prohibition. It's your narrative toxicity objective.
All right. Thank you very much.
All right. Dr. Hunter?
Thank you, and it is good to see you again. I appreciate the broad range of actions that you're involved in, so bringing that information to us as well and helping us understand some of the progress that's being made in the Central Valley region in particular. So that adds to your comments, so I appreciate that. I wanted to just mention or just clarify, if I could, your comment on replacement water. In looking at number 21 of the order, the comment, there are two parts to that. One is referring to Water Code Section 13267, which addresses an inventory or monitoring of domestic wells in ag areas. And the second part of that refers to 13304, cleanup and abatement, which you mentioned, as being a potential or a possible way. And in fact, it says the Central Coast Water Board may require discharges to provide alternative water supplies or replacement water. So I'm trying to understand what your comment, if you were trying to bring out a different interpretation, or if you felt that this statement in the order is misrepresenting what the water code intends?
No, not at all. What I was trying to convey, I think that the order has stated it is correct. It appeared to me from some of yesterday's discussion, in particular with respect to some of the conversations that you were having, that there was an interest in adding more to the order that basically specifically said, you know, X discharger under this order shall be required to provide replacement water. That was my concern, that outside of your 13304 authority, which is a separate action, that you would step in over a line and try to mandate something within your action that you're taking today. So it was more of a, you know, thinking of what, I wasn't sure what you were thinking about with the conversations that you were having yesterday, and so that was my concern and the caution I was trying to raise.
Okay, so I understand. You were responding to comments made by another stakeholder.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Because I think in that regard, I think, as you note, it is imperative that we find the correct path forward to, in the short-term sense, well, the metrics and the technical treatment and best practices and so forth, all of these things that we know are going to take a lot longer than we'd like to see. And in the interim, we know now more and more we have data about specific households, specific locations where contaminated water is the only source of drinking water. And as that data helps inform us, we do have other tools and other mechanisms which we, you know, are considering and moving carefully, because we are relying also on the cooperation and the collaboration with the ag community in recognizing that once we understand, once we have the data, action has to be taken.
Absolutely, and I think it's important to add that, you know, as in our experience with the, you know, the Groundwater Coalition, as well as Grower Shipper in general, every grower that we know who, through their well testing, has found, you know, that it exceeded the standard, has provided or offered to provide replacement waters to employees and, you know, tenants and everything else, and has been for years and years and years, long before this was ever part of the order. So absolutely, those things happen voluntarily and cooperatively, well outside this order. So I just want to, you know, recognize that it is something that the community has done and continues to do.
I agree. And that's what I think I was trying to emphasize as well, is that we are counting on that continuation of collaboration and cooperation. And we recognize that there are farmers who take responsibility for their tenants and for their employees, and that is a very good thing, and we certainly don't want to overlook that that is a long practice. So thank you for affirming what I understand, and coming from your perspective, that's important. Thank you.
So Mayor Delgado.
Thank you. And thank you also, Abby, for your comments before Tess started discussing hers. Tess, what I have is, as notes, is that you think that some form of applied and removed and residual nitrate is important to determine as a trigger if growers should implement best management practices, treatment, and control.
No, not as a trigger whether they should implement. I look at it as information to determine whether they are implementing best management, treatment, or control, right?
To
me, it informs. Okay. It informs a determination of whether a grower is meeting BPTC.
Okay. So how would a metric determine if they're implementing it? Because they could be implementing something intended to cause an improvement that just doesn't work, that's going to happen, right?
Right. So I guess the way I envision it, and I've given it, you know, a fair amount of thought over the last year in multiple different discussions, but you have a metric, and, you know, not talking about what is the appropriate metric, whatever it may end up being. But, you know, let's take as an example the range that was shown on the histographs yesterday of, for lettuce, there's this range between, you know, 120 and 158 pounds. That range, right, may inform whether a grower is in BPTC, but it's not the end of the discussion because, as was discussed by many people yesterday, there's so many other factors and variables that go into the grower's decision that, you know, whether to determine the amount of nitrogen that he needs with respect to his crop, that it informs. But it, then additional information gets added to it, and then the regional board uses that information, as they do with anything, to make a determination of whether, yeah, we think the grower, based upon the collective information, is implementing best practical treatment and control because they've taken into consideration water quality concerns, industry practices. BPTC is directed in state board orders. You look at similarly situated dischargers, depth to groundwater. All of those then factor in to the regional board's determination if a grower is implementing BPTC. So it's one of the factors that you utilize in that decision making.
Okay, thank you. And what form are, if you're advocating any form of a ratio, what form are you advocating in the Central Valley that they take up as a metric for informing but not being used as a regulatory target?
The current conversation, there's not a specific form that's being advocated at this time. There is work being done to evaluate different metrics, right? Right now, the Central Valley East San Joaquin order requires us to look at A over R in an aggregated township basis. And from there, we take whisker plots, box and whisker plots, to determine who outliers are, and we use that to educate and conduct outreach through our coalition to individual growers to talk to them directly from the coalition to the grower to say, listen, you know, you've come up as an outlier on this box and whisper plot. It's suggesting to us that you might be over-applying. And we use that for that A over our information for that specific purpose, right? But at the same time, we are conducting multiple different studies and programs in through the Irrigated Lands Program. One of them is called a Management Practice Evaluation Program, where we're actually, you know, starting with a model, a valley-wide model, to look at specific management practices related to groundwater quality to really determine what practices we think are protective of groundwater quality, including nitrate application rates and based upon soil type, irrigation type, and everything else accounted for, to come up with, you know, to really make that connection between what's happening on the land versus what's happening and reaching groundwater. And we need more of that information. So there's study processes going on to do that. Through that process and others, you know, literature reviews and everything else, there's a lot of looking at, is it A minus R versus A over R? Do we have the correct coefficients for removal in order to know that when we're subtracting that removal amount, that we're really getting an appropriate idea of what is remaining that could load to the groundwater? So all those are ongoing efforts right now. No one has, at least on the agricultural side, has said, we want this, but we're evaluating all of them. And what the Irrigated Land Coalition currently does in our reporting from our growers, we actually take A over Y. We take their applied, that where they calculate for us A over Y, and then we take from that information, we end up calculating the A over R ourselves. I think someone mentioned yesterday of concern with having a grower do an A over R calculation, and we would share that same concern that there's a lot of variables, and it could be something that then you don't get good data. But we are evaluating different ones.
Okay. Agreeing for the moment with Board Member Jeff Young that staff has presented us lots of graphs showing the highest toxicities in the Santa Maria Valley and the Salinas Valley correlating almost exactly with the higher agricultural intensive uses. So just for the moment, agreeing with that, even though there may be some...
Assuming some, arguendo, right? It's something we like in all of our briefs.
So assuming arguendo, what number of years would it take for you to be satisfied to see those rather intense toxicity levels come down? So you're advocating to, you know, base everything on the best information and not to use metrics for regulatory hammers, but to use them as information guides. And so would you be happy in 5 years or 10 years or 30 years or 40 years? How long do you think it would take if we did everything you asked us to do in the next 20 years that you ask us to do during that time? How long do you think is a reasonable time to expect to see significant reductions in the toxicities that are being measured?
Yeah, I not a scientist, don't know, but I guess I would put back to you, you have an adopted TMDL for the pyrethroids for the Santa Maria watershed, which is a 15-year time schedule for meeting the triggers or the targets that you've adopted within your TMDL. You will probably be bringing back before you sometime this year the Salinas River TMDL for the pyrethroids that will have a similar time schedule. So I think, frankly, your TMDL actions are actually dictating the time frame that you are looking for in order to see compliance with the targets that you've identified in your TMDL. So it really, to me, that will be the driving factor with respect to you know, meeting those targets. And again, they're targets because you still have a narrative objective. You don't have specifically adopted numeric objectives for the various pesticides, but they will be the controlling regulation that's been adopted into your basin plan. So you've allocated 15 years.
So you've repeated back to me what the board has done.
Yes.
And staff. Do you think in that case that you've mentioned that 15 years is reasonable? And do you think that it could be done sooner, or do you think that it will take longer?
I think it's reasonable. I have no idea if it can be done sooner or will take longer, but I think 15 years is reasonable.
Okay. And that's a specific case. And in other cases of the toxicity, do you think a 15-year time frame might end up being an appropriate goal in other cases?
I don't know. I don't know, you know, what the specifics you would be, you know, referring to. I think it's really hard to answer a general question like that.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Sorry. Go. Did I miss something?
No.
Okay.
He finished. So.
Oh, okay. Sorry, I was coordinating timing here, and I was certainly not trying to overlook your presentation, so I apologize for that. Mr. Johnson?
I've been very interested to hear the answers to the questions my colleagues have asked, and I don't have any other ones.
All right. And I have just a couple of very quick comments, and then I will hold off staff response for after lunch, okay? So one is a comment in regard to municipal use of pesticide, is that, you know, I believe it's 2 years, 3 years ago, landscapers and gardeners who apply pesticides have to get an applicator's license. So there is a way to track and differentiate application in in home garden, et cetera. When you hire a gardener, they are by law required to register with DPR. So that's one point. The other one is that I do believe that there's also the county has the ability of tracking amount of pesticides used I'll characterize it, the big box stores. Because
I think they can track sales. They can't track use, but they can track sales.
Which indirectly, you know, does provide you some of that information. So that was one little feedback. Let's see, I covered that. The other one, in Abby, thank you for acknowledging the good cooperation that has taken place in this process. And, you know, CDFA, a couple of years ago, maybe it's 3 years ago, you know, time flies when you deal with ag issues. CDFA had developed a model that is available online for fertilizer application. Any feedback on that about your members using this model? They had done quite a bit of research and, you know, trying to help with different crops. That I know it's a limited list of crops. Can you comment on that?
Yeah, and if I may, on your previous comment as well, on the 10,000 number that I used, that was just for five counties on the Central Coast, just to be clear. And in terms of the research that's been done on the nutrient uptake, I understand there are approximately 16 to 18 studies for different commodities. Some of them might be, you know, a spring versus a fall crop of the same commodity, but mm-hmm. that is important for us to know. And we have, I believe, around 150 plus commodities in our region. So while those studies are helpful to have, we need more of them. And what's the challenge that I hear from some of my members are that the studies might be conducted for an area in the lower Salinas, but they're not really conducted appropriate to King City or vice versa. And so with the evapotranspiration rates being very different, the soil type being very different, they can't necessarily be equitable to what's happening in another region. So while we appreciate them, a lot of the feedback that I get are, well, yeah, but it doesn't make sense in this situation or that, and more work needs to be done. And we have communicated that actually very recently to the team at FREP and are having discussions about what might be done.
Yeah, I was talking about the online model available for fertilizer applications that CDFA had developed. And you can include in there the various variables such as your soil type, ET, et cetera. And I was just, you know, curious to see how well that model has been used because, you know, as you know, increasingly, you know, we realize and that, you know, the Regional Water Board, we're not our own little island. So we work with DPR, with CDFA, you know, in more and more of a collaborative way in, you know, because we're really dealing with the same issue but from different aspects of our regulatory requirements. So
And I know that I have members that are using the crop manage model, if that in yes, with in working with my Dr. Michael Kahn
and
that model, yes, that model, yes, yes, and that have started incorporating that or looked into that model and how they might be able to bring it into use on their farms.
Yeah, because you know you have many commercial programs available. You know, I don't want to use for brand names. I don't want to give free commercials, but. You know, some people get accused of doing that publicly, so I stay away from it. But anyway, thank you. And what we will do, they picked up on my humor. what we will do now is to take a one-hour break. And yeah, so we're going to take a one-hour break, and then after the break, we'll get... You know, the feedback from staff, okay? Go ahead, Dr. Hunter.
Thank you.
I have an announcement. Do you want to go? I'm just going to announce the closed session. The board will be meeting briefly over the lunch hour in closed session to discuss significant exposure to litigation in light of Mr. Schimmick's statement yesterday that he intended to file a petition. We will not be deliberating in closed session because the public comments and the evidence hasn't closed yet, but we will have a brief discussion of the exposure to litigation.
I'm going to make a statement at this point that has no bearing on the regional board or on this hearing, but... some of you may be aware that today is International Women's Day, and there are demonstrations going on globally. So I am going to make the following statement, and some of us are planning to leave the room, and I hope that if you are aware of these actions and have already come to the conclusion that you are supporting these actions, that you are welcome to walk out of this room with us. The statement I'm making is that we are joining in solidarity in joint actions that are occurring across California communities, across the nation, and internationally in bringing attention to the need to raise awareness of ongoing forms of discrimination against women and current social, legal, moral, and verbal violence that continues to occur for women worldwide of all ages. And... I cannot tell you how proud I am to be a woman in this era and to sit on this panel. And I believe that I reflect the feelings of many of the women in this room who have experienced in any way, shape, or form what I just described. So I want to thank Chair Wolf in allowing me to make this statement formally. And with that, I'm going to shut off my mic.